The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, May 22nd, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rosie Collington, PhD candidate at the University College London, co-author, The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Government, and Warps Our Economies, co-authored with Mariana Mazzucato. Also on the program today, debt ceiling cave negotiations continue as Joe Biden flirts with his constitutional duty to pay the national debt. Meanwhile, Biden's polls in the toilet, but focus groups show Republican candidates are considered worse. Minnesota passes a bill ensuring minimum wage for gig workers. Now raise the minimum wage would be a good idea. Trump's lawyers apparently had warned him over taking classified documents and keeping them. Manchin announces he wants to sink Biden's labor nominee, Julie Sue. NAACP issues a travel advisory for Florida because of Ron DeSantis' policies. 8-year-old girl who died in Border Patrol custody apparently was denied pleas for care for over 24 hours. Bakhmut falls, or all but falls, and U.S. still believes Ukrainian counteroffensive is ready. Meta, nay Facebook, fined $1.3 billion by the EU for privacy violations. The FBI reportedly misused Section 702 to get info on Black Lives Matter protests and January 6th attackers. Lastly, Florida rejects social study books over Holocaust material. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Start of another big week. It is Monday. Of course, Emma Vigeland.
Hello.
Here with us for the beginning of the week.
Yes.
And for the rest of the week.
Yes. That so, too.
There you go.
Yeah.
We don't need to get into the Celtics. Talk about that later. You'll be able to talk about that on ESPN.
I will.
It's not
I will
really
be. I'm sorry.
Worth putting salt in the wounds. But speaking of salt in the wounds, we're on the verge of a cave. And it's not, I mean, there's a lot of elements about this whole debt ceiling thing. And let's be clear. This is obviously the a function of the Republican Party being completely off the rails and nuts. None of what the Republican Party is doing is in any way unpredictable, a surprise. They did it 10 years ago. They've done it since. But this is really, I mean, this is a replay of what happened 10 years ago. And
this is what we could imagine was going to happen last winter.
This has been an incredibly slow moving train.
Yeah.
And so since everybody in this room knew the Republicans were going to do this, the job of the Democratic Party then becomes, how do we prevent them from doing this? How do we make them pay a political price for doing this? And none of that work has been done. Joe Biden came out, declared, we will not negotiate on the debt ceiling, period. And they have done nothing but negotiate on the debt ceiling, period.
Can I give you a quote from Tim Kaine to Politico that'll infuriate you?
Sure.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia told Politico that if he could do one thing different, it would have been raising the debt limit late last year. The Democratic Senate aide vented to Semaphore that, quote, the debt ceiling could have been raised in the American Rescue Plan or in reconciliation during last year's lame duck session. On this program, we were advocating for that.
Oh, well, I mean,
hindsight's 2020.
Everybody was. And maybe you could argue that Joe Manchin wouldn't have gone along with it. I don't believe that. But let's just assume that you do. Then at least you know, wait, we still have this debt ceiling thing happening. We know the Republicans are going to hold us hostage. They the administration thought that maybe that Kevin McCarthy couldn't get a bill passed. But here's a piece from Brian Beutler. And he talks about Democrats like to mock Kevin McCarthy as the dumbest GOP leader any of them has ever had to work with. Nancy Pelosi, who had to work closely with George W. Bush over the years, famously called McCarthy a moron. Does Kevin McCarthy know where he is right now? Her office mocked. Well, joke's on us, because now Democrats will have to explain how that moron maneuvered to get them into a trap we've known about for more than 10 years. He writes, it is possible that the ransoms Dems pay won't be huge. It's even possible to imagine they won't have any immediate force. This goes into it being a, you know, upfront payment on a budget resolution. He doesn't, it's conceivable, in other words, that the material implications of this could be minimal. They probably won't be. They probably won't be. He writes, the impact on the federal budget will be approximately zero if it just so happens to be finagled in that way. However, he says, lower spending levels will stick, at least for the remainder of this Congress. Work requirements will take years to repeal. But just as importantly, any cuts enacted under these circumstances would betray the never again promise Democrats made after the Republicans did this to Obama in 2011. This point is particularly important if the ransoms are small, if the material damage has been kept to a minimum, because it forces us to focus on the violation of principle. The temptation will be to excuse that or to retcon it as some kind of clever Democratic victory over Republicans who are too dumb to understand budgeting. Why sow dissension in the Democratic ranks now if the option to sweep it all under the rug is available? And he writes, because people are smart enough to understand that holding Democratic leaders to account for their failures doesn't make those leaders worse than Republicans. Because we deserve savvier leaders who won't repeat obvious mistakes, particularly recent painful ones, who won't lay responsibility for their mistakes at the feet of voters or activists because they recognize that electing Democrats can't on its own solve problems that call for the application of raw power. Who can imagine standing up for themselves confidently against bullies as both dignified course of action and a source of political strength? Democrats can elevate leaders like that and beat back the larger threat of Republican takeover simultaneously. In other words, there should be a lot of criticism for everybody who participated in this program. The leadership of the Democratic Party, Joe Biden, his administration, period, end of story. Those senators who did not vote to raise the debt ceiling limit during reconciliation or thought it was a bad idea or talked it away or whatever it was. And that doesn't mean that Republicans are better. No. And it doesn't mean that you're letting things out of the bag. It is like demanding leadership that knows what they're doing. And again, the argument as to whether they purposefully do this because they want to cut the budget or not, we can have that argument. But this is specifically in the context of, like, even if the material implications are not there, this is just a massive political failure.
Yeah.
Because it's also going to happen again.
Yeah, I saw, I mean, David Dayen said it best in his piece in The Prospect today, saying, in this instance, the Republicans are appealing to their MAGA base. They want to have a get a scalp. They want to get some concessions here. And Democrats are appealing to their base, centrist op-ed writers who want the party to appear fiscally responsible as if it matters to anybody.
Civil rights lawyer Joshua Ehrlich said, I'm so tired of this loser. You're the president. Stop asking Sam Alito for permission to do your job.
Well, and here's the thing, to the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, here's Joe Biden speaking about the 14th Amendment, which calls for the United States to pay its debts. It is a constitutional responsibility for the United States to pay its debts. Therefore, there are no negotiations about this. You don't need Congress's approval. The executive branch is responsible for this. They need to pay the debt. In fact, it's not even an option. They need to pay the debt.
It's Constitution.
And how they get there, how they decide to do that, is their decision. We could throw it to Congress, but the Constitution says you need to do it no matter what.
Thank you, everybody.
This is at the end of his talk as he's leaving. Go ahead. Keep running.
Thank you, everybody.
We have not come up with a unilateral action that could succeed in a matter of 2 weeks or 3 weeks. That's the issue. So it's up to lawmakers. But my hope and intention is when we resolve this problem, I find a rationale to take it to the courts to see whether or not the 14th Amendment is, in fact, something that would be able to stop it. Thank you.
Okay, so basically what he's saying is that, well, we've run out of time. We had no idea this was going to happen, and we can't invoke. But after this, I'm so steamed about it. We've got to come up with a way of getting to the court on the 14th Amendment, even though there is no case that would be pending necessarily, because, of course, we're going to just agree to these cuts or whatever it is. I mean, this is so pathetic. Mm-hmm. If you could come up with a rationale after the debt ceiling fight, you could come up with a rationale before. But they don't want to go to the... This is so rudimentary, it's almost embarrassing to have to say. You don't ask for permission from a 6-3 Supreme Court. You basically apologize.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, Harlan Crow and his Supreme Court justices do not want
to go over the president's head right now?
And,
exactly.
And so had the administration, and you know, it's not a question of invoking the 14th Amendment. It's just you're following the law.
And they're protecting the court by not doing it.
Exactly. And
yeah, that's a good point, because if they just tried, then we can have a larger conversation about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, which we should be having, but they don't want that.
They're afraid.
Dick Durbin doing like one little hearing on Clarence Thomas. And is that all we're going to get on Clarence Thomas, by the way?
I'm sure. But the bottom line is they need to just pay the debt.
Yeah.
Stop talking about it. Just announce tomorrow, you know what? I spoke to Office of Legal Counsel, and in fact, we do have the authority under the 14th Amendment. It's pretty straightforward, and we just paid the debt.
Yeah.
And so, end of story.
End of story, and we just, last week, showed a poll, one of the premier polls from University of Chicago on confidence in the Supreme Court. They do it annually. Lowest it's been in 50 years. So if the Supreme Court decides, like, hey, we're going to let the U.S. economy fall apart because of concessions that the Republicans are trying to get over just paying the United States' bills, then that's a further ability to undercut the Supreme Court's legitimacy, which is in the interest of the Democrats electorally in the midst of abortion and blah, blah, blah.
What's amazing about this is that there was a Washington Post focus group that looked at 16 voters who had gone from Trump to Biden in 2020 and followed them before then. And they all feel like Biden is too old and they don't want him and they're mad. And then when it gets to Trump, they're like, but he is a nightmare. And yeah, we don't want him as bad as Joe Biden is. And so the point is that the narratives of him being afraid, you know, to be considered an authoritarian or to have gone to the Supreme Court or whatnot, people just want this done. This is a made up thing and they are playing along and it is a real failure. And there's going to be, I mean, you know, again, would I vote for Donald Trump over Joe Biden because of this? No, because the cuts would happen. I mean, it's obvious. But the point is that there's going to be blowback and it may not be from me, but there's going to be, you know, like it's going to seriously impact the way this goes. And Boitler's right. You can call for leaders that are savvy and do their jobs well. Mm-hmm. End of story. Maybe there's no way he does it. But yeah, there's no doubt. Also, there's some apparently advisors who are pushing it in the administration, but there are others who are pushing harder. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Rosie Collington, PhD candidate, University College London, co-author of The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Rosie Collington. She is a PhD candidate at the University College London, author of The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies, co-authored, with Mariana Mazzucato. Rosie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on. I was just saying I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm a big fan of this work. I've been a fan of Mariana's for quite some time as well. Then I got to say that's also a very very long subtitle that you have. But I want to cover. I mean, I think it really does lay out the problem. Let's before we get to how consultancy does that. Give us a little bit of a history of the development of it. We just had, I think, someone from ProPublica on a couple of weeks ago talking about McKinsey. Mm. And this is McKinsey, but there's a couple others. There's three major consultancy groups, the Boston Consultancy Group, the Bain and McKinsey. But what was the and then, of course, the accounting firms that also do a lot of consultancy work, PwC, which I learned from your book. Mm-hmm. What was the birth of this? Because there's sort of a chicken egg type of dynamic going on a little bit, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of core argument of the book, right? We call it The Big Con, but when you get to the end of the book, you learn that The Big Con is actually about the relationship between governments and these companies and not just something that the companies themselves are doing, right? So they do employ these mechanisms. They do invest a lot in creating the impression that they are creating value for our economies. But obviously, this is also an issue with how governments contract them that we talk a lot about in the book as well.
Yeah, let's start with like the development of that, because, even if these consultants were, and we'll go through this, didn't have the conflict of interest that you talk about in the book, even if they didn't sort of weren't expertise and sort of being able to pretend they know what they're talking about, it still is a problematic in terms of the institutions that hire them. But how did this develop? Like, when did this become a more significant phenomenon, and what was driving it?
Well, we have a couple history chapters in the book, which everyone is welcome to read. The first chapter really looks at the development and the growth of this industry with kind of wider developments in capitalism, right? So from the end of the 19th century all the way throughout the 20th century. I guess the part where it gets the most interesting for our contemporary situation and the challenges that governments are facing and, you know, really being able to govern is when we get to the 1980s, which might not be a surprise to many of your listeners if they're familiar with the politics and economics of Thatcher in the UK and Reagan in the US. So what we saw during this period from this decade of the 1980s really onwards was that governments introduced reforms that simultaneously reduced spending or reduced resources directly invested in welfare services and increased the use of the private sector in delivering them. And this was really done under this kind of ideology that the role of government should just get out of the way because it doesn't know how to create value for society. What came after that in the 1990s with Clinton and Blair was not so much a continuation of this, right? Because these governments, these subsequent governments that came after Reagan and Thatcher, they did see a role for government in kind of setting the agenda and determining what was valuable for the economy and for society. But they didn't see, they agreed with their kind of predecessors, their neoliberal predecessors, that actually government was less efficient than market. And therefore, as much as possible, they should hand over to the private sector. And it was really, during these decades from the 1980s that we've seen the kind of huge rise of consultancies, of management consultancies in government services, delivery, in policy development, in kind of providing advice to government departments. But, you know, we're really interested in the book in the kind of implementation side of things. So what happens when a government department outsources at scale and scope? What happens to the capacity and the knowledge that exists within that organization and the ability to develop it?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, before we do that, I just want to make that distinction between implementation and policy development, because that's also, problematic. It's one thing, I guess, if you're a small town to say we can't maintain our own fleet of plows to plow when it snows. It's just not efficient at that way. We're going to hire local guys with pickup trucks and with the other trucks to plow. It's another if I say, and we're going to let them decide when we deploy the plows, because then all of a sudden, half an inch of snow and they're going out there because they have an incentive. Just talk about that dynamic before we get into some of the actual case studies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was going to come back at you with a case study. So one of the cases that we look at in the book is the development and implementation of healthcare.gov, right? So this was the platform for market exchange that was part of the Affordable Care Act. And it was really, you know, the landmark reform of Obama's period in office, right? And what we discuss in the book, what we look at in the book, is the scale and scope of outsourcing, of contracting out, that occurred in the development and implementation of this online platform, right? This wasn't a case of just bringing in a few experts to advise, which, you know, with new technologies, it's almost invariable that governments and any organization are going to need some specialist knowledge and specialist experts to come and advise from the sidelines and help them implement that. And also recruit new people in. But this wasn't a case of that. This was a case of outsourcing the development and implementation of healthcare.gov to some contractors, including CGI Group, which is an IT consultancy. It does a lot of management consulting work. And, you know, as many of your listeners will be familiar with, it was a colossal failure on the day that it was supposed to launch. Massive. In October 2013. Only six people were able to get their health insurance. You know, it was an obscene failure.
It was an obscene failure, and both in terms of the material implications, but that the failure of that website was talked about for years as an example of government incompetence. And in fact, it was private. It was the private industry failure that it was all about.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. And this is where it comes back to the big con and the problems that we have in our economy with the way that governments and businesses also use consultancies. This being an issue of not just the companies themselves, right? Not just the supply, but also the demand, the way that governments see that they should be outsourcing in these ways. So there were problems with the way that the government chose to contract these contractors to develop healthcare.gov. But absolutely, I mean, the failures, the types of failures that have been talked about in the public sphere have been failures of these big companies basically failing to deliver what they promised to deliver. But of course, it was also a failure of government, you know, contracting them in the first place. But you know, largely, as we kind of find in the book, the conclusions that many other analysts have drawn have failed to look at the companies themselves and the systemic imperatives, the interests that they have when they're getting these contracts with governments in the first place.
Well, the interest that they have, I'd love if we could flesh that out for a sec, because every consulting company talks about efficiency. Like, that's their buzzword, right? I mean, we saw this within the context of the train derailment in East Palestine as well, where these companies are contracting consulting corporations, and they're essentially saying, how can we make this corporation as lean as possible for shareholder value? That's a simplification, but I mean, I'm sure you can expand on that. But the fact that these governments have adopted this as well, it really speaks to the financialization of our politics over the past four or so decades, that this has become largely consensus, not just in the private sector, but in a lot of governments, including like the US and the UK.
Absolutely. I mean, it's no coincidence that the growth of this sector and the growth of governments outsourcing came at this time of kind of the rise of neoliberalism in countries like the UK and the US. You know, just to give you an example, at the beginning of Thatcher's tenure in 1979, the UK government was spending about £6 million a year on external contractors, on management consultants. By the end of her tenure, 11 years later, it was 246 million. So that was a huge increase in government. And a lot of the things that government was contracting these management consultants to do was things like advise on privatization, advise on increasing efficiency in public sector services. Now, the problem with, you know, a kind of government by efficiency, right? So one thing is that we all agree that government should not waste public money. Governments should be efficient. They should be effective with public money. But the problem with having that dominate the way that we run government is it completely excludes other things that we should be taking into account when we're thinking about the capacity and the ability of governments to do things. So if we just focus on these efficiency measures, these short-term efficiency measures, so what can we do in the shortest, most effective way, in the cheapest way, if we just focus on that, then we lose, for example, an account of what implication does this have also for the knowledge, the training, the development of our employees, their livelihoods, the conditions of their job, ensuring that we're, you know, respecting labor agreements or collective agreements, and improving those conditions. You know, these kind of wider implications are completely ignored when we're only focusing on this, you know, short-term cost benefit, cost effectiveness.
I mean, it really is about defining what the goals are in this instance, right? I mean, because when an efficiency consultant comes in, the goal is efficiency, as opposed to doing another job efficiently. If that primary job is to take care of your citizenry, let's say, broadly speaking, doing that should come first. I mean, this is the fundamental difference between business and government, it seems to me. And you're bringing people in with a business bottom line perspective, whereas that's not what government is supposed to do. It's supposed to help as many people as possible without, you know, and then maybe do it as efficiently as you can. But let's go to, I mean, I guess we can see this in the context of like McKinsey again in the opioid epidemic in this country. Their role both with Purdue and with the with the FDA. Will you walk us? This is an example of the conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't actually talk about this example in the book, not because it's not important. It's very important. I can talk a little bit about it, but it wasn't a focus of the book because it is quite a unique case. And we're really interested in the book in what cases tell us about these broader systemic issues. But certainly, you know, it's an example of a conflict of interest because McKinsey was simultaneously advising Purdue on how to, it was being paid, it was earning a lot of money from its contracts to advise Purdue on how to turbocharge sales of opioids, right? So if this company then has this incentive to, you know, I'm going to take this kind of one step kind of further back, because I know we have to be careful when we talk about cases that we haven't talked about in the book, you know, legally, and right. You know, this isn't something that we focused on. But let's take this one step further back. If a consulting company, in abstract terms, if a consulting company secures a lot of revenue from a client, then it has an interest in securing future revenue from that client. So it wants to give advice rather than giving advice that might be kind of in the long-term interest of that client or in the interest of society, in the interest of the healthcare of a population, that the fact that it is seeking future lucrative contracts from that client invariably, and very often, of course, does shape the advice that it gives to that client. So it's more likely to provide advice that, you know, solely prioritizes the bottom line rather than any of these other considerations that we've been talking about. And I think, you know, it could be argued that that happened in, you know, McKinsey's involvement and McKinsey's advice that it was giving to Purdue Pharma.
What other examples would you give for that type of conflict of interest in how it hits, how it impacts? And again, this is a subset of the problems, but they all contribute to the sort of institutional weakness that government has in terms of being able to respond to anything.
Yeah, one area that we focus on in the book quite a lot, actually, is the growth of climate consulting. So this is a kind of nascent booming sector, or booming market for existing consulting companies. So all the big three and the big four, the names we mentioned earlier, all of these companies have invested heavily in their climate and sustainability consulting divisions over the past few years. And we see this, their growth also in the fact that, for example, BCG was the first ever consulting partner of the Conference of Parties in Glasgow, the UNFCCC Conference of Parties, the kind of big global meeting of environment ministers and other people who are important in environmental policy. They were the first consulting partner at this conference. This market is expected to be worth about $8 billion by 2028. That's probably a conservative estimate. I read another estimate the other day that suggested we're already there. This is also an area where the companies have a huge conflict of interest, insofar as their biggest clients are, or some of their biggest clients are, in the fossil fuel industry. So to give you an example of kind of how other people, commentators, have suggested that this is kind of manifested, the Australian government, under the previous government, paid McKinsey $6 million to do the analysis underpinning the government's net zero strategy. Now, subsequently, climate analysts found that this strategy was basically full of holes. It didn't actually get the government, it wouldn't get Australia to net zero by 2050. So it wasn't actually kind of setting up to do what it was saying that it was going to be able to do. And then other people started pointing out the fact that, hang on a second, McKinsey has advised 43 of the 100 biggest polluters. Could this be a reason why this climate strategy, you know, actually didn't make much sense? It wasn't actually very successful. Could this be a reason why the government contracted McKinsey to do this analysis rather than, for example, investing internally in their own or spending the money internally in their own kind of climate science division, which they do have in Australia? To do this, and in which case it might have actually been a better report.
Let's also talk about in the context of businesses. You talk about consultancy brought in as a sort of a shield in many respects. Talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, so this is very common in business in particular. It also happens in government, but let's focus on business. So just to kind of put, just to illustrate what we mean when we're talking about this in the book, we might find a situation where there are two executives of a company that have a competing vision or want to kind of implement a competing strategy and they disagree on something. So what they might do in that situation is contract one of the consultancies to do kind of analysis that supports their argument in this internal case. And this is something that came up a lot in interviews that we did with consultants who worked in businesses, who worked in the corporate sector. You know, they were saying this happens all the time. We're brought in to rubber stamp decisions that have already been made, and it's quite frustrating.
And what does it do, like broadly speaking, to warp economies? Is it simply that the warping happens in the context of efficiency becomes paramount, or is it also that there are irrational programs implemented that are irrational unless you look at it from the perspective of the consultant?
I mean, both of these, but also fundamentally, you know, if we live in democratic societies, these are supposed to be societies, these are supposed to be places where decisions that are taken in government and also in business are in some way accountable to citizens or in business to workers often. In many places, we do have labor agreements in place. And what the introduction or the contracting at scale and scope of these companies can do is obfuscate decisions that are made in business and government. It can make it very difficult to challenge them, to question them, to even know what's going on, what the process was in the kind of decision-making process of a policy. So in various different ways, it warps the economy. Certainly one of them is that, you know, we end up with a very warped, skewed idea of what constitutes like kind of an effective use of public money, as we've already discussed in terms of efficiency, but also because it obfuscates accountability around decisions, which is an issue for democracy.
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys call consultology, mm-hmm. Because and some of it we've touched on as to why you might bring in consultants. But will you talk about what the consultants do, these companies do to, I guess, project an expertise that they don't really have, and it. I'm fascinated by this part because there is this presumption that these people do know exactly what they're talking about. But so many of the situations that they are in are unique enough that they, having never been part of the system, they couldn't possibly have genuine expertise at it.
Yeah, great point. Great. Yeah. So we talk about this a lot in the book right now, as I've already said. The growth of the consulting industry is not just a function of what these companies do, how they invest in creating this impression that they are able to create value for governments and clients and businesses, etc. But they do invest a lot of resources in creating the impression that they are the best people to do the job, if you like. They do this in a few different ways. So we know historically, you know, at least since the 1960s, the big companies have had a recruitment strategy where they recruit only from quote unquote elite schools, you know, elite graduates. And there's a historian called Christopher D. McKenna, who is a historian of management consultancies. And he's looked at how, for example, at Harvard Business School during the 1960s and 70s, it became McKinsey's strategy to just recruit from that cohort, from the top 5% of that cohort. And they did this because unlike in auditing or law or many other professions which require a formal qualification and which are regulated, unlike in all these areas, management consulting is not a protected profession. It's not regulated. Anyone can call themselves a management consultancy. So they have to find legitimacy in other ways, right? And one of those was, yeah, recruiting, or is still today recruiting from these elite schools. Now, you know, other things that they do are to establish what we have described in the book and which some other economists have described as quasi-academic institutions, right? So you might have heard of McKinsey Global Institute, which is probably the most famous one. Now, this is staffed with some. Kind of incredibly intelligent people with PhDs, again from top universities, who certainly, you know, are often experts in the areas where they are doing research. But McKinsey Global Institute produces reports, and these reports can be full of really interesting knowledge. But a key function of these reports is not necessarily to distribute this knowledge. It's to market McKinsey as this kind of site of expertise and give the impression that the kinds of people who are going to be on the floor of your business or your government department are the ones who have this expertise, which is just rarely the case. The people who are working in McKinsey Global Institute are not the graduates who have, you know, 1 or 2 years of experience working in McKinsey, who tend to be the ones going into the shop floor. So, yeah, I mean, there are lots of different ways. Again, we talk about it in the book, the things that they do, the strategies that they employ to help create an impression that they are creating more value than they are. And, you know, we're very clear in the book to say they don't, it's not that they never create value, or that there isn't, you know, real intelligence and real expertise in these organizations, but it is certainly kind of not at the scale that is presented to us.
Right. I mean, it's a net value to society at the end of the day. Yeah. It's also, I found that fascinating, the imprimatur they get from sort of the top line academics at these, you know, institutes, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to, like, shower down, I guess. I mean, it's at least there's some consistency maybe in terms of like a trickle down economics. This is sort of like trickle down qualifications on some level that they're imposing. But what is problematic necessarily? Is there anything problematic from just getting everybody from Harvard? Like, I understand the dynamic there, that if you have a lawyer, they are accredited by the Bar Association. They've had to pass a bar. They've had to do certain things to create qualifications. If, you know, you're a therapist or something, you know, your qualifications indicate how much scrutiny you've had to achieve those qualifications. In management consultancy, you graduated. And if it's from Harvard, it sounds more prestigious. But is there a problem in and of itself with just getting all these consultants from a very small subset of people?
I mean, it depends, you know, what way you look at it, and whether we think these consultancies kind of have any value as these generalists that can go in into different functions in the economy. You know, we don't focus in the end, actually. At the end of the book, you know, other people have argued that consultancy should be more regulated as a profession. And this is going to be the solution to the problems with consultancy that many people are identifying today, you know, both in response to the book, but also more broadly. You know, we think that the issue is more systemic than that. We think the solutions to the problem that we identify in the book are not going to come from kind of small tweaks to the way that consultants are recruited or the way that their profession is regulated. Actually, this is a systemic issue with how governments work, how we think about the role of the state and of government in our economies, and how we understand learning and, you know, all of these things that we've already talked about. This is not something that will just be fixed by, yeah, regulating the profession, unfortunately. But nonetheless, what I've described earlier is an important way that they help to kind of create this impression that they are legitimate, kind of neutral brokers of expertise in our society.
Let's talk about some of those solutions that you advocate. And I wonder, you know, I mean, I guess the book has been out for a couple of months. Do you have any sense of like the feedback? Has there been people in government who sort of look at this and go like, oh, I see. Or, I mean, how, before we get to the solutions, I mean, I'm curious about that. Has there been like reactions to like, this is a problem, or like, yeah, no, we have a sense of this, but it really does insulate us from, you know, criticism, or it maintains my job. So thanks, but no thanks.
So, well, I mean, when we were writing the book, and we've been doing research in this area or adjacent to this area for a long time, we know that many people who work in government, and I'm not talking about necessarily politicians, though certainly many politicians also have, but many civil servants or people, just people who are working in the public sector, public employees, I guess, as you call them in the US, many of these people who have encountered or had to work with consultants in various guises, they identify a lot of these problems. They already know a lot of the stuff that we're writing about in the book is a problem. They don't necessarily, or before the book, you know, they didn't necessarily have a framework to kind of situate it within these broader problems and have something to point point at. You know, if they are trying to challenge something by themselves, if they're trying to challenge a decision to contract out something to McKinsey that could be done in-house, they don't necessarily have the tools to do that themselves. So, you know, part of what we wanted to do with the book, we had realized through our research that this was an issue, but also, you know, not just kind of introduce some new terms to the political debate, but give people a tool within government to, you know, question the things that are happening in governments as well. And I mean, the response has been, I'm not just saying this to sound great, but the response from governments, from some governments has been very, very good. Yeah. So we've had, for example, we were contacted a couple of weeks ago by someone from the Senate who told us a Senate inquiry into the Australian government's use of management consultancies and issues with how they manage conflicts of interest in response to the book. So obviously that's a huge kind of great response. In terms of other conversations that we're having, you know, we've been invited to speak to policymakers about the issues in the book. Some governments we haven't heard much from, including the UK government, which might be for obvious reasons. They're busy with maybe, I don't know, saving, messing up the economy, whatever right. They do. But yeah, no, the response has been very good. And we're contacted on a daily basis by people who work in the public sector. Also many people who work or have worked as consultants, you know, just saying to us, this is exactly what it's like. This, I've been doing this for 20 years and this is exactly what it's like.
So where are the biggest sort of structural reforms? What are the most likely or, you know, I guess from lighter lift to heavier lift in terms of like the structural reforms?
So I don't like thinking in terms of likely and unlikely, right? Because actually the most likely ones are the small tweaks, which aren't going to change a lot. But the most necessary ones are the big systemic reforms about the remit of government, about how we think about government and its role in the economy. We front load that in our kind of list of solutions, this more systemic transformation that we see needs to happen with how we talk about government, how we think about government. So we're not just thinking about it in terms of this kind of cost efficient actor that has to get out of the way as much as possible and let the market do as much as possible. But we recognize it as an economic actor in its own right that is there to deliver stuff and do things that citizens demand and want of it. You know, that's how we should see the government and as our kind of collective economic resource or as the thing that can bring economic resources to as many people as possible. Beyond that, though, we do also have reforms that can be implemented maybe on a more day-to-day level at the kind of level of government departments when they are thinking about contracting an external partner to really be thinking about, does this actor have the expertise or the kind of necessary experience that we need in-house? How are we going to learn from this? How are we going to get this knowledge, this learning back in-house? How are we going to absorb this when the contract is finished so we don't have to just keep going back to the contractor over and over again? We do provide some tools, some mechanisms that we think can be implemented. But fundamentally, you know, as with Mariana's wider work, we also think we need to rethink the role of government in our economies.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me as I was prepping for this, we recently under the Inflation Reduction Act, or I can't remember exactly which bill it was, that added about 80,000 new IRS agents. I mean, to be fair, it didn't necessarily add those as much as it authorized the refilling of those seats that have been, you know, those positions that have been lost because of prior budget cuts and anticipating attrition going forward. But we're already seeing sort of these reforms with the IRS in terms of like making it easier for you to file your taxes, getting your rebate quicker, just more efficiency and presumably more audits of wealthier people who have been evading taxes, essentially, so that it's going to generate more revenue. This feels like the type of thing that should be more celebrated as an example of government working efficiently. We have such a problem, particularly in this country, with demonizing government agencies, even ones that do well, like the post office is amazing, as far as I'm concerned. Even our DMV is quite effective, in my opinion. And yet, that seems to me to be almost like a political project as much as anything else. And I guess it has to start with the politicians.
I think in part, but it's also, so the US, I'm saying this as someone from the UK and I live in Denmark, right? UK and the US are quite similar in this respect. One of the responses that we have had to the kind of solutions, these systemic changes that we propose in the book is, oh, are you just calling for big government versus small government, blah, 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 blah. And that is totally the wrong framing. You know, we are right. In the era of big government. Trump was big government. Reagan was big government in many respects. You know, spending on the military during Reagan increased something like 35% every year on average. These are big governments. So it's not a case of big government versus small government. It's what the government does and how it does it. That's what we're trying to address in the book with our proposals. I think we need to get away from this kind of framing of big government versus small government completely, because it's a total falsehood.
Yeah, no, I agree with that as well. Rosie Collington, the book is The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break, and we will head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half, free of commercials, but you get the fun half as well. And you can IM the show via the free app. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget, AM Quickie, amquickie.com. And you can become a member of the Discord at majoritydiscord.com. All sorts of things. And also shop.majorityreportradio.com. Pick up some merch. You'll enjoy that. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check that out. And somebody just said, every time Sam says the DMV instead of the RMV to appease the non-assholes, I cry on the inside. It's DMV. Is it not DMV?
Yeah, the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Is it something else in Massachusetts?
Maybe it's the RMV in Massachusetts, but I never knew that.
What would that mean?
Registry of Motor Vehicles?
Yeah, Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Why they got to be different
here? It's just a registry, not a department?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know when that...
That makes it better.
That sounds like a Mitt Romney.
Yeah, honestly.
Reform. I don't go by that. I still call it the DMV. So.
Good for you.
Yep. Although, actually, now that I think about it, when I say it out loud, I say the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Sus.
Yeah. All right. Massachusetts. Go ahead, Emma.
ESPN. Yeah. Bye-bye, Celtics.
I mean, it's a little bit early.
No, it's not.
They get four games.
Kind of time. Four
more. Losing both.
Could be a turnaround. Could be a big turnaround.
Could be.
So, actually, the stat is 149-0 are teams in NBA playoff.
Went down 3-0.
When they're 3-0.
Well, how much more of a dramatic time would you want to do it than to be the 150th opportunity?
Well, either the Celtics or the Lakers have that opportunity, and I think both are going to fail.
Yeah. Well, and both will be doing kind of a discussion of those collapses and just, like, honestly, dominance by the Heat and by the Nuggets. We'll talk about Jimmy Butler and Jokic just being on another planet. And Matthew Tkachuk in the NHL on another planet as well. The Arizona Coyotes losing their referendum to stay in Arizona. No one wants them there, but the NHL is forcing them upon them to get a piece of the southwestern market. We'll be speaking about that and more. And also some anti-Palestinian discrimination in footy. We'll be touching on that as well. YouTube.com/ESPN show today at 4 p.m.
Matt,
It's happening on Left Reckoning.
This Sunday for Left Reckoning patrons, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. David and I talked a little bit about Elon Musk, several stories to do with Tesla, and also about RFK Jr.'s appearance with Crystal and Sagar. So patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get our takes on that.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a wow! What a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare! Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
Black.
Come on.
Black.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy,
total
pussy,
total
pussy,
total
pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy, total pussy.
We are back. Emma Viglin, Sam Cedar, fun half of the show.
That was beautiful.
Some Hugo song voice.
There we go. There we go.
Fun half.
There we are. Don't think they're going to be recording too many more Bob's Burgers because they only had a certain amount of scripts already written. We're also careening towards a SAG-AFTRA strike. As well as the DGA is coming up. The DGA less so, but the more I read and hear about and talk to people about the writer strike, the more it is becoming clear that there is a big fear of AI. And, I mean, we've already seen examples of, I think Tesla, did you see that clip? Can we get a hold of that clip? The Tesla one with Ryan Reynolds?
I mean,
this is, and this was done a, my understanding is maybe without his permission. I'm not
100%
sure.
Without his permission.
And and the dynamic is interesting. There was a time a couple of years ago where they were putting like Marilyn Monroe and John Wayne into commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Did they do MLK too?
I don't. I don't know if they did that. But the point being is, when you sign these, when you sign these contracts, very often the nature of these contracts are: we get the rights to this in perpetuity in all mediums that exist today and in the future. And there is a big fear that what the producers are looking to do ultimately by, you know, we've talked about the gigification of writing. Used to be you get on a TV show, you're in a room, 10 people, 12 people, 15 people, you're writing scripts, you know, you got a 9-month contract or a year long contract or a 6-month contract, and you're there every day and you're working on things. And increasingly, it is going more towards a model where, you know, there's one writer and day players are brought in to punch up stuff. And there is a fear, I think, amongst the writers that what these studios are ultimately going to do is just have a AI write the script. And then we bring in a couple writers here and there to just do punch up. And that is not a living for writers. Mm-hmm. There's also a fear that you're going to sign contracts to act in a show, to voice a show. And once they bank enough of this stuff, they can just start creating these shows without you. Do we have that Tesla video? Yeah. Papa, just give you an example of this.
Yeah.
Apparently Tesla did this.
Well, sorry. The story behind this is some Tesla fanboy did this by himself. And I'll be honest, I don't think the quality is... It's a more proof of concept.
A proof of concept type of thing. Yeah, this is a Tesla fanboy did this. It's funny because you had Elon Musk saying, like, this, you know, we've got to regulate. But when Elon Musk says you need to regulate something he's involved in, my sense is he's already found something that he thinks that he can leverage the regulation against competitors.
Just a real quick note on that. A whole bunch of people who are invested in AI are also talking about it as like, we need to regulate it. And I'm very suspicious that they're not just using that as a way to drive more investment. But here's this.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds. How much do you think it would cost to own a car that's this fucking awesome?
This shouldn't be legal, by the way.
Right.
None of this should be.
That's the coolest thing ever. What if I told you you could own this car for less than the lifetime cost of a Toyota Corolla?
Okay, so there it is. Now, the bottom line, that's not Ryan Reynolds. It needs to look better.
But if the voice sounds like a dude did this with his computer,
it's going to be a problem.
I saw a point, Sam, and I'm curious what you think about this, because famously, Hollywood sort of producers can't read mail scripts that are sent to them because of litigation regarding like plagiarism.
They'll send a document to you saying
we can't open this.
Well, they'll also, or if they want to, they will send a document that like sort of releases certain liability and whatnot.
But like that, how does what's the legal liability here with regards to AI scripts? Because I imagine like you're going to, what are they being inspired by? But like scripts that are fed into it as a database.
I mean, that's the thing. Is it materially close enough? I mean, that's where there has to be government regulation. Yeah. But also in these specific instances, the guilds need to defend this. And the Writers Guild have been doing a great job. They've been getting a lot of support from like Teamsters and from other unions like SAG-AFTRA. Here they are protesting a talk by David Zaslav, the CEO and president of Warner Brothers Discovery. He was at the, I should say talk, I mean, he was at the BU commencement. And students, I mean, this is the problem that business is going to have and is having now. This is why the Writers Guild strike is different this time around than it was, whatever it was, 13, 14 years ago, 15 years ago now, because younger people are much more in touch with the rights and power of labor. and regardless of what that labor is. And you would not have seen, I can assure you, 15 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago, and definitely not 30 years ago, people at BU in any way doing this.
You want to be successful, you're going to have to figure out how to get along with everyone. And that includes difficult people. Some people will be looking for a fight.
Oh, I love them.
Wow.
Pay your writers. Pay your writers.
And you know, the thing is, with a guy like that, that really sticks in his craw.
Oh, yeah. This is his moment in the sun. Is he a BU alum?
I don't know.
Yes, he's probably like, I'm back. I'm the successful alumni. Here I am.
Got my Ray-Bans.
Yeah. I mean, this is to the extent that something can be effective, this is effective. Like, yeah. You know,
I'd love to get him talking to his family. Like, so how'd it go?
Damn kids. BU has changed.
It's not me who's out of touch. It's the kids. But just back to the AI point, I think that the things that we, like, from the left, we should be most concerned about when it comes to AI is not the takeover and, like, it's going to surpass humans, like some of these tech executives are saying, but that it's going to be used to undercut labor in the way that you describe. Like, I still think it's in its infancy, and I mean, some of the scripts you see AI churn out are kind of silly or whatever, just as a test case. But potentially in the future, that's what it's going to be used for. That's how it needs to be regulated.
Yeah.
Not so Elon Musk or Google or whoever can get rich off of it, like from IP, but so that there's labor protection so it doesn't supplant people.
Yeah. I think it's going to move very quickly. I was talking to a guy who was involved in machine learning, you know, has been doing it for years before it was called AI or really in a lot of respects, and just working in the logistics area. And he said, like, this is like electricity. Like, it's like the advent in his mind, the advent of electricity in terms of like what the implications are going to be. And we're still very much at the beginning of this.
I'm a little bit in between. Like, I think, like, for instance, the automated, if we could do a Spanish version of Majority Report, first, that will take a lot of computing power to put this entire show into a program and have it spit out a speak in Spanish,
right?
The entire thing. That is way more functional and useful than anything I've ever heard of with cryptocurrency, for instance. At the same time, I do think part of it is, and I can't help but feel that, like, this is like a whole bunch of things are being lumped that used to be called like smart technology or this and that, and it's basically like the new tech booster way to sell investors on a lot of things. Like NVIDIA, the GPU maker, is trying to make up for like fallen demand post COVID crunch by selling future like AI capabilities. And Intel, the same chip makers, like they're selling the stuff in a way that's like, to me, it's there's like, unlike crypto, there's something to it, but I also think there's like a 50% boost on it in terms of hype because it's an investor sort of priority.
Well, both things, they're not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
You can both have it have this massive impact and also,
right,
like crypto its impact
was, it
and
was
its,
exclusive, like, yeah, it was just speculation.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, I
Jennifer from St. Louis asked, what's the Spanish for
Yeah.
But you know what? I could probably get the AI to take out the and the stutters.
Yep.
So that would be pretty good.
But then you lose the contours of the show. And I mean, like, look, it's just...
Is Sam without the ums?
Yeah, I don't know if that's right.
I
it's
guess
not
that's
your
a
brand.
Question for AI.
But that's going to be the massive gap here. And that's why I'm a little bit closer to Matt on terms of my skepticism. I think it's being oversold without, like, the very human elements that are necessary to producing any kind of work as a way to boost investment. I mean, there was all that hype about lab-grown meat and self-driving cars. I know it's not the same thing, but for the latter example, there's some automation involved there. And then what did we find out? That technology is so far away, and it was just there to drive money into the coffers of people that wanted to work on, like Musk himself.
Yeah, and one final note is, like, people say that, and they said this for crypto, but I think it's, like, more of a arguable for AI, is, like, what if it has the same impact on society as the internet? And one, like, I think it's kind of a continuation of the internet, but even put that, like, the only people that really benefited from the internet, really, like, that could, like, say, retire earlier, are people who made passive income bets on stock markets or something like that. Like, look at wages. They didn't increase because of the internet. So, like, I also think the who owns this stuff is a bigger problem. And that's where you get to, like, it's a labor thing, because that's who is going to be able to deploy AI technology, is people who want to do labor saving.
Yeah. Oh, but I think that is the, I mean, regardless of whether you what impact you think AI is going to have, it is the political structures that are going to determine, are we literally just going to be made more productive by it and not get any and not share, and who gets the benefits of that increased productivity is always the question.
Yeah, because I gotta say, I was watching a terrible, trashy reality show called Selling Sunset the other day.
You love it, that show.
If you listen to the music in that, it could be made by AI.
Oh, yeah.
And you would lose absolutely nothing except for the money that goes to those creators. It's just a problem, but there's no actual artistry to some of that stuff. I think, like, that's the low-hanging fruit that AI is going to challenge, is like the stuff that is pretty, like, tonight it's gonna be all right, and then like
right, but that's exactly, it's like all of the music is just a variant of like the same three percussion patterns, lyrics about partying and not caring about tomorrow, and they could totally replace that with a computer.
Yeah
Majority Report wardrobe coordinator says maybe AI will fix the camera heights.
Camera heights are good. Well,
we're aligned.
The problem is that I'm just so much taller than
him. Yeah, Sam is 6'6". That's
yeah, there I go.
Yeah, I grew over the weekend.
Got that surgery.
Yep. The
leg lengthening thing.
Surgery.
Wasn't there some story about a guy that happened
to? He gets 6 inches, apparently.
Yeah, and it ruined his bones or something. Predictable outcome.
Go with the IMs. Nutty Fuace. How many times awards did the Majority Report win again? Did I mess that up in the beginning?
Five times.
El Conniption. Sam, what happened to the Celtics? Blah, blah, blah. And how many times have you watched The Town? I haven't watched that at all.
The Town is not...
Are they just saying that because of the coach?
Yeah.
What do you think of that movie? I mean, like, that's like... Have you seen The Town with Ben Affleck?
No.
No, really?
No.
Okay, well, it's a Boston movie.
Ben Affleck. Dude grew up in Cambridge. El Conniption. Last night, the Heat fans were chanting 3% because ESPN stats and info gave Miami a 3% chance to win the series against the Celtics.
I saw that.
Conversely, I guess Boston fans chant 3% for a completely different reason.
Oh, that's amazing.
3% is 99 problems, but chain't one. Hey, Sam, my girlfriend of 4 years just proposed to me this weekend. Can I get a shofar? Congratulations. Did you say yes? That would be pretty... That would be a little bit cruel. Can you give a shofar? I said no. Leach, when are you all coming to Minnesota, where we just passed legal weed, help gig workers, first state to legalize drug paraphernalia, even with residue on it, codified same-sex marriage and abortion rights? Would love to see you all live. August.
Love that.
We doomed for another 4 years of, oh, no, we can't get anything done if Biden gets elected, reelected. Is Joe afraid of Republicans calling him the authoritarian for invoking the 14th? What the F? I mean, I think it is unlikely that we're going to get much done unless the Democrats hold the Senate. And for me, the idea of placing 200 or 300 judges on the federal judiciary, lifetime appointments, is huge. It is absolutely crucial. I mean, you see what happens right now when we have, when Trump was able to put 200 on the federal judiciary, and we still are dealing with Bush nominees on there. it makes a big difference. We're going to need this. We're going to need a judiciary that is willing to allow the U.S. government to do things to help the American public. And that is a prerequisite, a foundational prerequisite to having, to, in my mind, to having certainly elected officials and legislate in a way that we like, but also in terms of like labor power. I mean, what are the implications of if you strike, you've got to pay your boss for lost revenue? I mean, that you've got to, it is the functional equivalent, not necessarily the moral equivalent of, you know, Haiti having to pay reparations to France for saying that we're not going to be your slaves anymore.
Yeah.
It is the functional equivalent of England having to pay off their slave owners. And that's going to be a decision made by a judge. Toma Flink, happy fun day Monday, folks. Here in Britain, senior Tory MP went on TV recently, tried to defend sewage in public waters by claiming that he swam in sewage during his youth. You couldn't make this shit up. Also, according to Tim Pool, milquetoast fence sitter is when you donate $20,000 to the Legal Defense Fund for a guy who's on camera choking another guy to death on New York subway station platform. Rave Dubin, he gave 20 grand to, what's that guy's name? Penny. Penny's defense fund.
Jesus.
Rave Dubin, Trump just does what he wants and waits for the courts to rule against him. Maryland has an MVA instead of a DMV. Elon Musk completely botched the quote from The Princess Bride when he asked why does he do it. Inago doesn't say, I don't care. He says, I want my father back. Interesting that this is the movie Elon thinks of how he rewrites the line so he doesn't have to deal with the emotional damage of not having his own father around, also not being around for his own children, and openly hating one of them.
Mm.
Mike Klein, Berkeley. Greg Sargent or some other reliable reporter on Twitter pointed out a few minutes ago that Biden's already a party to a 14th Amendment case they could ask to expedite. Stupid thing, too, is make the Republicans stiff bondholders for a month or years from now alone. If the court or a future Republican president says those bonds are canceled, that's not going to happen. Evil Axer, I hope the Republicans impeach Biden for refusing to enforce the Constitution. It's possibly the most obvious cause for impeachment and conviction. Willow, ZipRecruiter, Business Tinder. Lawful Waffle, Sam, Bone and Crew, was thinking this debt ceiling topic can garner more support from younger people by rebranding it as Raise the Roof. Thoughts?
If by younger people you mean 50-year-olds, I think that's when that phrase was popular.
Dr. Dragon Rider, former financial analyst here. We all know that the U.S. dollar is the world's base unit of measure, but every single AAA and AAB, et cetera, rating from Moody's automatically lowers the rating of every fund in the world that holds them. We have to reevaluate all of them and those fund cash values as well. The money market and safest funds who primary hold U.S. treasuries are about to be the most risky. Do we want the reserve currency of the world to become the euro? Last time Libya tried to start a regional currency, we invaded them. We can't invade Europe. Juniper J, I can't help but believe that if Ron Klein was still chief of staff, the 14th Amendment would have already been evoked and this crap done with. Right or wrong? Enough already. Now Biden has decided we'll begin training Ukrainian jet piloters, fighter pilots, which means they'll be receiving fighter jets at some point. How close to a nuclear war are we going to allow this to get? I'm not sure. I mean, sure, the Ukrainian people should not be in this position, but F it. They are, and it's time for people to get real. I'm not so sure Ukraine would be better off as part of, wouldn't be better off as part of Russia. Well, I mean,
what?
I mean, okay.
Well, they have the right to make their determination on that front. Who is writing in like this?
Amazon thug, union thug for life. Great show today, MR crew. Purgatory, perjury, failure, streets. Imagine how aggravated Trump must be that his presidency didn't occur during a writer's strike. Sounded like he really let those late night shows get to him. Trump voice, if this happened when I was in charge, they would have rallied together just to be mean, nasty to me. Nobody else. Nobody's ever had to have someone or anyone, frankly, multiple people so mean they just had to do it, right? Vermont Bend, the I-90 traffic around Worcester on Saturday was awful, as anticipated. If only I had the Worcester traffic report brought to you by the majority report to inform me beforehand. Join the street, Hunter in the sheets. Joe in the street, Hunter in the sheets. Hey, Sam, over the last few months, you have read out loud several pro-rugby texts. Please stop. Rugby is the preserve of privately educated posh Tory boys, on par with a pheasant shooting, and the only exception is tiny English village called Wales, where it is genuinely popular. Hearing you utter the word ruck last week made me want to vomit. I have to be honest with you, I did not know that that word ruck was a rugby term.
Well, our friend Tom is a rugby fan, so we read his IMs. I'm so sorry this is so difficult for you.
New Jersey mailman says we shouldn't bow down to nuclear blackmail from Putin. I mean, the problem is, you know, part of that dilemma is if you are genuinely worried about a nuclear war, is that what makes you think if you do explicitly acquiesce because of Russia's nuclear power in this instance, what makes you think they're not going to do it again somewhere else? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there's a big dilemma. I don't know that I would go as far as Jets, frankly, because then you're, you know, allowing for even more opportunity for someone to be flying over Russian territory. But I think, you know, this is a function of the offensive, and they're trying to set up for peace talks, would be my guess. I know there was a delegation from Africa that is headed there to attempt. Supposedly the Chinese have attempted. I suppose it's conceivable that the Ukrainians want to negotiate, but the U.S. is not letting them. I think it's what's more likely is that U.S. and NATO, by arming Ukraine, is enabling them to keep fighting. I mean, I think that's obvious. But I don't know that the will to fight is a function of the United States and Ukraine. Really, the question is, do we continue to, you know, fund this war? What is the limiting principle? It's hard because I would like those answers, but it also makes sense to me that you wouldn't necessarily broadcast those answers because then you're basically telling the invading country what the terms that you want out of this are, and nobody knows for sure what that would be. How much territorial integrity will Ukraine have after this? In what areas, et cetera, et cetera. So opening up the phone line, 646-257-3920 is the number. What should we get to?
Lindsey Graham. This Moms for Liberty. Moms for Liberty.
Which number is that?
Number six.
Six. Okay.
All right. Let's play this here. It really is stunning what we are witnessing in this country. With every day, I feel like we have a different story. Florida. The Department of Education rejects social study textbooks over Holocaust material. 33 social studies textbooks were submitted to review for the Florida Department of Education were rejected for not meeting state standards. Those textbooks cover everything from civics to financial literacy to the Holocaust. It's unclear why they rejected it. Mark Hopin from the Alpert Jewish Family Service in West Palm Beach said highlighting it's providing care to including 200. Highlighting that point in history is critical to prevent it from happening again. The Holocaust, it didn't start with guns and death camps. It started with words. It started with, sadly, some of the words we're hearing in Palm Beach County today. Some of these anti-Semitic leaflets and projections of swastikas. We're asked all the time by high schools, sometimes elementary, can we bring a survivor to speak to students? And the survivors love it. But the Florida Department of Education brought some new Holocaust educational material into question as it adopts new social studies textbooks. The state released several examples of textbook material that was rejected, including a description of the Black Lives Matter movement. But we don't know exactly what was in the Holocaust textbooks. The state said the history of the Holocaust book received a 3.7 score out of 5 for aligning with subject-specific standards. And a book needs at least 4 to be accepted. A textbook titled Modern Genocide received 2 out of 5. Florida requires instruction on the Holocaust for all students beginning in the 5th grade. But of course, you know, there's probably a requirement for slavery, too. But to how you teach it and from what it emanates from. This is going to sound inflammatory, but when Ron DeSantis wins his election and says we are going to be the anti-woke state, what does that mean? If that's not. It's not necessarily the case that you go from that into full-on fascism. But let's be clear. You cannot get to fascism unless you go through what DeSantis is going through. You don't get to fascism without saying, we are the anti-woke state.
And what does wokeness mean?
Right? Exactly. But
wokeness is a substitute for blackness, but you just can't say it. Blackness, but it's expanded now to, of course, like LGBTQ people. Yeah. But in its outset, you know, the term woke was like a term previously used by black people to describe people that were enlightened on issues of racism. And now they've made it into a substitute for blackness.
Just like the standards that they're imposing on the schools with Don't Say Gay and all these other books. The point is, you can't define it.
Yeah.
And that it is subject to all of the people who's hearing it, what their interpretation of it is. And therefore, it has an even greater chilling effect. And it also has a greater, like, sort of inspirational effect for the worst among us. Here is a clip. This is the Faulkner Focus on Fox. This is on Saturday's CNN, I should say. And Darcy Schoening, Moms for Liberty chapter chair in El Paso, Colorado.
Behind your parents' back. I got your back. I mean, there's a clear move to bring more of that into our schools, and it's just not the school's place.
So what I feel like you're strongly implying, and I would like to get your take on, because I don't want to attribute something that you don't think, but to me it sounds like you're saying there's some kind of high-level coordinated effort to make more children trans and gay.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, who's directing that?
Teachers unions and our president and a lot of funding sources. And teachers unions are also heavily backing the curriculum that we're bringing into schools.
Why would they want more kids to be gay and trans?
Because it breaks down the family unit, which breaks down traditional conservative values. It breaks down a lot of things in this country. It changes the way that people think. It changes the way that people handle politics.
Of course, there's no evidence of a coordinated plot to make kids trans.
When I hear those thoughts about like some sort of concerted effort to make people gay. Does it sound like a conspiracy theory to you?
It's not a conspiracy theory that the state, like whether you're talking about Colorado or the federal government, is taking a stronger and stronger hand in public education, in raising our kids. So do I think that for some reason people want everyone to be gay? That's a mischaracterization of what I think. I think that people will use, you know, the people that want to erode away at parental rights, the left, the teachers unions, they'll use LGBTQ or whatever may be the case at the time. Those are just tools to erode away at parental rights.
Well, it was refreshing to hear her say the teachers unions like multiple times, given what we have spoken about on this program multiple times, like about how attacks on teachers unions are fundamental to the right wing project right now.
Yeah.
And that means attacks on teachers. Teachers are a broadly unionized workforce, except if they work in private schools and things like that. So,
well, to be clear, the union is just coordinating the plans with the Joe Biden.
Oh, I forgot.
To indoctrinate our children into being gay and trans. And why?
Because they hate families.
Because they hate families. And
it's a political indoctrination project. I notice how similar that is to Great Replacement, by the way, which is that like the Democrats are bringing in immigrants from over the border to get more Democratic votes in. I mean, that's like one shade of it. But that's what they're saying here. They're trying to indoctrinate our kids into being gay and trans so that they vote Dem. It's like an electoral conspiracy.
What's also fascinating is this theory that both I will teach my kids values. The better place for me to teach kids values is at the home.
Right.
Yet they're quite convinced that the teachers have the ability to turn their kids trans to go and debilitate the home.
The parents' rights being challenged here is the parents' right to make sure their kids can't pursue a lifestyle that they don't agree with.
Yeah, right. But wow, why do all those every mom looks like that mom who's like, yes. And they all look
you
alike.
Know, Joe Biden, like, to the extent that he has any sort of cultural, like, sort of desires to see, like, cultural develop in a certain way, we saw him talk, when he talked with black leaders before he was sworn in as president, he's like, we'll do it with commercials.
Yeah.
Don't you notice how many, like, how much diversity there is in commercials? Like, we're actually moving somewhere. Like, that's the extent Joe Biden wants to put his hands on the scale, is he wants Dannon to have an interracial couple eating yogurt.
It really is. I don't know how you reach someone like that.
You don't.
You have to beat them. Yeah.
Yeah, you can only defeat them. And by the way, so that's...
Well, what's fascinating is the fact that this is happening in Colorado, because you do get to a critical mass where every time a mom for liberty like that comes out and is given the opportunity to espouse that kind of, like, now she wouldn't say it's a conspiracy theory, and she wouldn't say that they're doing it just because they want to turn people gay. It's not like some, you know,
they don't want everybody gay.
It's not that it's the gay agenda. It is really more that it's like just a tool in which to elect Democrats by turning everybody gay.
Gotcha.
Maybe you could just turn them into Democrats, but you know,
but no, that
doesn't stick.
You need to sneak them into the household and tear down the family structure, because that's the ultimate thing. Is this is a religious war they're fighting.
Yep.
That's ultimately it. But every time one of those moms from liberty type people, whenever they're given the opportunity to articulate this in public, it should be, particularly in these contexts, because the more that people see how nuts these fundamentalists are, the better, I think. Because make no mistake about it, they're doing all the organizing, whether we hear it or not. They're doing all the organizing. Whether people are made aware of it or not, they're doing all the organizing. They have their own network, like literally, like radio, TV, you know, communications network. They're doing all the organizing. It is really important that people understand what this is about. It is about religious fundamentalism. I don't think she said explicitly in that clip that she was a religious fundamentalist. I would be willing to bet everything I own that she is.
Yeah. Yeah. And also good job on that reporter there. She used to be at Vice, and she's done a lot of great work.
Elle Reeve.
Calling from a 405 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Hitchens Ghost from Bay Area. I'll go by that since I'm going to have a federal job here.
Okay, Hitchens Ghost in the Bay Area. What's on your mind?
Yeah, great to talk to you guys. Sam, Emma, Matt, Bradley, you guys are great. Matt, I learned a lot from you and all you guys. So I kind of moved to the left kind of in the Trump years and as like idiots like Dave Rubin moved to the right. So I kind of saw him in the middle and gave him the finger on the way by, I guess.
Nice.
But I want to talk about, and that's late in life for me too. I know Dave Rubin gets made fun of for that, but I'm an idiot too who just like watched Fox News when I was a kid with my parents, was in the military. And I wanted to talk about Colonel Grossman just a little bit.
Colonel Grossman? Who is
He's the guy who wrote that On Combat. And he's,
oh, right. Yeah, we were talking about him the other day. The guy who goes around to the police departments and trains people.
In killology.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a total psycho. That guy that called about him, I mean, he used kid gloves to say the least. That guy is a total psycho. So when I was at in Oklahoma, am I yelling? Sorry if I'm too loud.
No, go ahead.
That guy... A little nervous. First time to call, long time, you know. But so when I first joined the military, I was about 22, and that guy, they paid us all like 500, 600 people from the base to go listen to this guy in like a community center hall, and he, even back then, I was like, Jesus, this guy, like, this guy's a psycho, and I was like a right winger, gun, like, water the tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants, like, idiot, you know, just that stuff sounded sexy to me. I was young. It was post 9/11, all that crap. So, anyways. He's up there with wide, crazy eyes. I mean, as soon as you talk to this guy and see him, you realize he's a complete nut. And he's like, make no mistake, we're in a holy war. You know, this is the land of Christ. I mean, openly Christian stuff. And like, he was so proud of training the Chicago police and the Turkish police. And the Chicago police trained to, I guess, pull out their gun and shoot twice and then put it away. And then he claimed, well, they were doing that in real shootouts. So he trained them. Empty the clip until they're no longer moving on the ground, that sort of thing. He was real proud of all that, and he kept talking about holy war, and these jihadists want this and that, and Muslim hate openly, all that stuff. And I Googled him since, and he is a religious fanatic, speaks at all these different, you know, Christian events, all these things. And I'm saying a lot here, but I also wanted to just say that I've thought for a long time, I mean, the reason my handle is Hitchens Ghost is because I've watched too much of that crap and Sam Harris, and I'm aware of all his problems. But and Hitchens' support for the Iraq war. But I really do think that he's got a very important point, and they've got important points, that this religious bull crap is really tied in to what's, like, deteriorating everything about all the stuff you guys talk about, public schools, the way government works, all that stuff, the military, industrial complex. Religion is so baked into that, and you see this with Israel and all that, that I just wanted to highlight that that guy, if he's involved in Cop City, and I don't know if we've confirmed that, there's going to be, I mean, I would predict there's going to be people shot and killed directly with his voice echoing in those officers' heads once they train for war, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's my main piece I wanted to talk about.
Well, appreciate the call. I couldn't agree more with that, with how our politics are being driven by religious fundamentalism these days.
Yeah, there's a classic.
Appreciate the call.
There's a classic Chapo Trap House bit that you can find on YouTube. Chapo Trap House, Killology and the Police, talking about Grossman. And I like the younger 1980s sort of Marxist Hitchens, but the atheist Hitchens, he does have something that I think about a lot, which is he said that in terms of the battle of ideas, it's the literal versus the ironic mind, literal being basically fundamentalist and ironic being able to, like, determine that words have different meanings in different contexts. And I think he was absolutely right about that.
Calling from a 217 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, it's Ash from Southern Illinois.
Ash from Southern Illinois. What's on your mind?
I was wanting to go back on Friday. I was listening into the show. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit nervous, but about that story in Haworth, Illinois, about the teacher having a police report filed on her.
Oh, right. And then the one that and this is for introducing a, like, How to Be Gay book in her book reading club on Mondays, and she ultimately resigned. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just looking back and So I'm trans, pretty much not even 2 hours away from there, and I cannot overstate how much that would have helped me back then. Like, sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. But,
no, how would that have helped you to have been introduced? I mean, it sounds like you grew up in a small town like that as well. I think Hayworth had something like 2,700 people, and it was a very homogenous town, to say the least, but also tiny. How would it have helped you to have had a teacher who basically said, you know, people can be gay, people can be trans, here's a book that we should all discuss as a class, going through, and let's be clear, this is not the only book that they had. Every Monday she would introduce another book. I mean, that's, you know, 30 books, 25 books. So it's maybe, I don't know, 5% of the reading that they're doing, if that. What would it have done for you?
So to expand a little bit on that, I was raised in a town that is less than 1,000 people. So it is very white, very homogenous, and basically that whole shtick. But it, like, I went through a depressive episode, which caused me to drop out of my high school. And having that knowledge and knowing how I could have seeked help back then would have benefited me so greatly.
Were you in any way indoctrinated to become trans? You're in that town. I mean, it's a ridiculous question, but I mean, it is the premise of like everything that we're hearing, right? Is that the reason why you became trans was because it was introduced to you. It was normalized for you. Maybe it was from a teacher or somebody else basically said, not only is it okay for you to be trans, you should be trans. Did anything like that happen to you when you were growing up?
When I was real young, elementary school age, I can't really explain it, but I had this, always felt like there was this distance between me and the rest of my classmates. I, sadly, a teacher never indoctrinated it into me, but it's hard to explain.
Yeah, I can imagine, but I guess my point was just that this was something that was internal to you.
Right.
Yeah, it was always inside.
Well,
but
I appreciate the call.
Thank you for taking it.
All right, thank you. Thanks for calling.
And want to give a shout out to you guys for helping me through with my political, you know, growing and everything. So thank you and have a nice day.
That's right, what we're here for. Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah, folks like that, like in, you know, growing up in North Dakota, there's a certain type of like contrarian liberal that I think mainly lives on the coast that thinks like everybody is anti-trans in the middle of the country and understand that actually there's the same amount of trans people there and they just have like greater odds. So like this sort of treating this as if it's sort of like some debate and not an attack on populations is extremely frustrating to me.
And frankly, my sense is, too, is that the average person just about everywhere, the average person everywhere doesn't much care about whether someone they know or not know is trans.
Yeah.
Like, I can understand it. You know, like parents have expectations for their kids and it may take some time for some parents to get over the fact that like their kids are not, you know, going to be how they had anticipated their kids going to be. I mean, I can understand how that could be hard for some people. But broadly speaking, I think most people, average people, are like, it doesn't impact me. I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
I think most people were willing to, like, you see, like, in states that were extremely against gay marriage, for instance, how fast that
Overnight. We showed those polls. Exactly. Like, if you look at the polls in 2010, 2008, as to marriage equality, and then look at them again by 2016, when the decision was basically made in 2013, it's like night and day.
And I think a lot of people were willing to just basically like continue the trans acceptance on that until it became a campaign priority for the Republican Party.
And people buy into that stuff. And like, there's a trans woman who's suing a yoga studio here in New York City for forcing her to use a different bathroom or something. Or I mean, the point is just that this is all over the place, this kind of discrimination. And it's usually coastal people that make a claim about the middle of the country that they don't know.
I'm just speaking for the bigotry of the middle of the country, not my own bigotry.
Right.
Call from a 919 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Taylor. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Taylor, what's on your mind? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from North Carolina. Just a few things. I was wondering if y'all had read any of the work of Gene Mickel and what he's writing about and what's going on in North Carolina in the General Assembly, specifically at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, how the Board of Trustees is defying the Chancellor and creating this, like, alternate conservative school, called like the School of Civic Life, I believe.
No, I haven't followed that at all.
I can't speak to too much about the just beyond what's in the news. Recently the Board of Trustees has, like, for the first time in any of, like, the people around here can remember, are forcing the Chancellor's hand to, like, support a creation of a new school that no one really knows what it does or what it's supposed to be, but it's called the School of Civic Life. And it's just the whole idea, I guess, is just that it's to counter the left leaning whatever at UNC, like the rest of UNC. The Board of Trustees president has been going to Fox News to brag about it. And I just think, just as a guest recommendation, Gene Mickel, who wrote a book called Lessons from North Carolina, he would be a great person to talk about what's going on down here.
All right. We'll make a note of that. Appreciate the call.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. There's a couple of states that are just getting off the hook. Ohio, Florida. North Carolina seems to be headed down a very distressing path.
It's wild, Minnesota going the opposite direction. And I'm seeing, like, certain sort of trying to understand how the Democrats got so much of a spine. And part of it is they've had a divided legislature for so long that they've basically allowed promises to build up. And now it's time that they have the power. It's like they can't really even say we can't do it.
We're seeing the same thing in Michigan, too. I mean, it's interesting. North Carolina, you could have predicted. It would not have been unreasonable 15 years ago to say, like, in 15 years, this is going to be a blue state. Mm. And it's still, you know, at best purple, maybe like a little bit more reddish purple. You could have also said the opposite with Michigan. And as of even 6 years ago, people were saying Minnesota could be going the wrong direction. And it seems to have reoriented.
Yep.
Calling from 404 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello, this is Dez from New Jersey.
Dennis from New Jersey?
Dez, D-E-Z.
Dez. Dez.
So I'm calling because I wanted to parrot something that you had said last week. It was very short, and it's a simplified idea of just for people trying to organize their workplace, they just need to kind of just do it. I'm currently in the middle of contract negotiations right now. We won our election in October. Emma, thank you for the show far when that happened.
Oh, nice.
And and I just want to say, if I could just say the story of what happened at our job, I've been kind of I've been slowly radicalizing the people at my job saying hey, unions. And people are just yeah, that seems like a good idea. You know, there's a lot of people that are kind of just we might lose our jobs. But eventually it was an amalgamation of like, COVID definitely helps to get people on our side, but, you know, the general consensus was just like, hey, if you think it's a good idea, you should do it, talking to me. And eventually I was just like, all right, I'm just going to go ahead and just look up what am I supposed to do? And this is before I even knew what EWOC was or anything like that. Saw the idea, many articles, actually, if you just Google it, would say, like, it's probably a good idea to have a committee. It's probably a good idea to, like, figure out what people want out of a union. And so I just did that before even contacting the CWA.
Mm-hmm.
And not to even, like, I'm not trying to boost my own ego when I say this, but eventually we had a meeting with, like, a coordinator who met with the committee that I had built. I brought them a list of all the employees that worked there, all their roles, who would probably be with us, who would probably be against us, including, like, a mission statement, the goals that we have, and just the plan of action. And when I brought it, she was very surprised, like, absolutely shocked. And that, to me, just said, like, they were willing to meet if I had not done that.
Right.
Like, as simple as just reaching out, contacting someone for help, they will help you to even do the stuff that I had already done.
How did you know to do that stuff?
I literally just Googled, like, how do you unionize? And I'd seen, and I forget what sites, but once you parse through all of the, hey, here's how you can get out of paying union dues, like, sponsored links on Google, you'll find a bunch of articles just saying, like, these are just the steps that you need to take.
Right.
And I just did that. You know, I learned a lot in the process.
And there's other resources. There's the Emergency Organizing Committee. Is it EWOC? Is it? And,
yeah, the EWO. Yeah, it was before. So it was before I even knew about that. I learned about that after, like, you know, going to, like, DSA meetings after the fact.
Right.
I didn't even know about that. And I don't even think they were one of the resources that I had before doing it. So all the information is out there for people that are interested. It's, again, if you aren't even comfortable talking to the people at your job, there is someone that can help you get comfortable out there.
Right. Every step of the way.
Yeah.
If there's any inclination that somebody has, I mean, you can do what you did, then Google it. You can get in contact with EWOC. I mean, and none of these things are mutually exclusive.
Right.
Go to your local DSA, and they'll also have some ideas. I mean, folks can check on the Discord. At this point, we have not only, you know, 8,000 people, but we have people who we've been through this multiple times now. I would also recommend going and listening to the interview I did with some of the Starbucks workers from Buffalo. And I mean, just
exactly.
These are all people who, for the most part, not all, who are basically just, like, working at their job and going, like, this sucks. We need to get some union representation. And I mean, that's the advantage, I think, that now that, like, people have, is that because there's been this development in the past couple of years of independent unions and organizing that's taking place in spaces that didn't have organizing before, both in terms of, like, industries and sort of the type of work, there's so many more resources for basically this almost, like, I hate to use this word, but, like, this sort of, like, organizing entrepreneurship, as it were, because that's what it is, right? It's like you're basically starting out and you're doing you're creating an entity.
And then the other thing is, like, because, again, I wanted to go back to exact, like, what you said last week to me was, like, the perfect thing. It's just simplified as just, like, you just got to do it, because it's like, not everything, like, you know, we went to the CWA, not everything is as sexy as, like, the Amazon or the Starbucks or the Trader Joe's or, like, the fighting the huge, huge corporations. And, you know, you can just find out what, you know, union organizations do cover your industry. And, like, it's easy to find. And that's how I was able to find the CWA, because they cover state workers, and that would include people that do, like, motor vehicle work, and, like, we are a private entity that does that. It doesn't have to be, like, the big like wave that everyone is expecting from like seeing people fighting up against Starbucks, for example.
Right. Oh, and I, someone just reminded me too, read Jane McAlevey. I mean, watch the interviews that we've done with her, read her stuff.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah. It's
all great resources. You do all those things and you will know, you will have so much sort of like institutional memory, I guess, on some level, just downloaded into you. And then you got to just do it. You got to do it.
Yes, just do it. One final thing before I go is I've sent so many emails of a, and it's so far gone at this point, of the Chinese spy balloon flag to you. I've sent you a little picture of you drawn holding like a crate of apples as a stock boy. I did a Jordan Peterson Think Again Sunshine graphic.
I haven't seen those. I mean, we get so many emails.
I know you do. I know you do. So
give me just like one word as to like how we can find your email address, and we'll search it in there.
I'll send one today before I go to the meeting.
Okay,
it'll be
great.
Dez. It'll be D-E-S. Dez will be the first part of it.
Okay, great. We'll check it out.
All
right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Peace. Bye.
All right. Let's do, should we do this clip? Number 9?
Sure.
Okay. This is, odd. And what were we talking about the other day where we thought, where they were comparing, what was it, the N-word with
white supremacy.
Yeah. There, you know, this is what we're going to see. This is all
part of Marjorie Taylor Greene said. Yeah.
This is all part of the same thing. The idea that we can't say the N-word is oppressive to us, and the way that we will, you know, and the idea of describing our behavior and a subset of people is really an attack on white people. Wokeism is an attack on white people, according to them. Political correctness, all of it. This is all, I mean, this is, it really is eternal. You can go back to the John Birch Society. You can go back to, you know, Barry Goldwater.
Heritage Foundation.
I mean, this is all part of a whole. It's always so fun for me to see Will Cain doing this stuff, because this guy had a completely different media personality when he was at CNN. It's really interesting to watch.
And he did like the sports transition too. Like he was on ESPN for a while, but I guess got bored of that.
Got to make a job. Yeah. You got to make a living. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I was having a conversation with someone about, you know, Tucker Carlson. He just realized, like, I can make $20-25 million a year by doing this shit, and I don't care. He didn't care.
Yeah.
He didn't care at all about what he was saying. No. He had proved that over the years. He was so P.J. O'Rourke cynical from a young age, and it's like, $25 million? I'll do that. And that's what he did. And here's Will Cain. He's not making $25 million, that's for sure.
Well, let me just say really quickly. So this is in reference to a viral video that I was a guest on John Iadarola's show, The Damage Report, and we got it wrong, right? I didn't really know the segments we were doing. I kind of came in and just was like, I'll contribute. And so I should have done a little more research on this. And this is why we shouldn't comment on viral videos until we know more about it. So apologizing for that for sure. But this is what they're referring to, because a lot of people jumped the gun on this video and it ended up, you know, having some more details to it.
Okay, I don't know even the backstory of that.
This woman got into a conflict over a city bike, and she was called a Karen because she was fighting with some black men or boys in this segment. I'm not sure how old they are, and it ended up being that she paid for the bike, as opposed to them thinking that they paid for the bike. That's the backstory.
Okay, so
politics.
Yeah,
here we go.
But in today's America, you must see race, and you are required to take the side of any black person in incidents that also involve a white person. Evidence does not matter. And not only do you have to side with the person of color, but you must immediately believe that the incident is racial in nature. So because of these rules, Sarah Comrie is white and the five teenagers are black, and therefore Sarah Comrie is automatically racist and at fault. Those are the rules in America. And the media headlines immediately followed those rules, referring to Comrie as a Karen, which is a new racial slur for white women.
Well, I mean, honestly, why would he say it if it's a racial slur?
K-word.
Because
say the K-word.
I mean, yeah. Well, the K-A word, right? We got to we gotta be specific.
Well, Kane is out here spewing racial slurs on Fox's airwaves.
I mean, is the FCC going to get involved here? We need a fine for Will Kane.
This is just running interference. And, you know, we didn't cover this video on the show. We don't.
To be honest, I would never cover viral videos on this program if I was making an editorial choice.
Yeah, but maybe that should be some guidance for people going forward.
Yes.
Right.
Lesson learned.
I mean, there are some instances where I think it's, you know, it's pretty clear. I didn't see the actual underlying video of this, but there are some instances where it's pretty clear.
Well, yeah, it's a pattern recognition. Like, we saw this in New York and Central Park with that woman who called the cops on that guy with the dog.
That's what people were comparing her to.
Many situations like that. But the idea that Karen, this is, I'll tell you what's happening here. This is Will Kane, yes, to be fair, and I don't want to, I don't want to ignore this. He is clearly pandering to the white supremacy crowd. But what he's also doing is really pandering to the key demo of Fox News, which are white people. That's indisputable. Older white people, and I imagine a few women. There's probably not a lot of women, but there's a few women who watch this. And but many of the men here are married to women who are going to come back and complain about black people. And so what this is sort of like a preemptive strike. It is a instead of a future crime, it is a future defense that, again, trying to get license to be able to say or do anything in society that is bigoted or whatnot without any pushback. They are trying to develop their own sort of like what they perceive as racism is like the unfair advantage, essentially. When you say someone is racist, you're hitting below the belt because it's unfair.
Yeah.
You're just using the, in their mind, made up history of the United States being racist and the made up existence of racism today, and you're weaponizing it against white people.
And it's just like, sorry, like, you should be able to understand, like, okay, I'm sorry that this society that, by the way, the woman who got Emmett Till murdered just died recently. Like, sorry, there's people are a little bit see a little bit of patterns in certain.
Yeah,
things.
I mean, right, and jump to assumptions. Yeah, right.
I think I headlined that at the time, but I wanted to talk about it more because you talk about like the perspective that we are told that that kind of racism, like the one that gets people lynched, literally, by the institutions of a town. That woman just died.
Oh, she got to live a long and cozy life.
But my point is that that's not that long ago.
Right.
Like, you know, like even if there was no institutional racism that has continued through, even though there wasn't sort of de facto racism, like, for instance, when the IRS realizes, like, you know what? We've looked at our data. We don't target black people for audits more than white people. However, we end up auditing more black people than white people. That's built into the system. I mean, this is critical race studies. When you start to realize that the way our society was structured, even if it wasn't explicitly on racial grounds, it was a function of who's got the political power in a given time. And they structure it in a way that helps them, not other people. And so you'll get this type of de facto racism. That's what critical legal studies is, or
race theory
is. And So that stuff is still sort of existing and vibrant, and we're living with every day. There's you don't get the explicit, forgive the use of black and white situation you get with Emma Till, but she just died. So, like, you know, that's not even that far in the past. And this is Will Cain just trying to make sure that, like, look, we're doing everything. We're out here doing everything we can to make sure that when you're racist, you will not be called racist.
And that's why, like, you talk about that or the Jussie Smollett thing for, like, months on end. So you can talk about the, like you said, the news of systemic racism, for instance, the IRS stuff. And you can just basically, like, have your own counter message that overpowers that.
Maybe all these instances of racism are false flags. That's what they want to suggest.
It's a way to get ahead for, like, you know.
And the idea that Karen is the equivalent to a racial slur, please. I mean, if I say it's okay, I'm a white woman, but, like, also, it's not all white women are Karens, right? It's a state of acting like I'm the manager, I like to speak to the manager. That's the whole vibe.
Hashtag not all white women.
Yeah. Hey, we're not all Karens, please. Yeah.
Yeah, which one is that? Okay. DeSantis is... Yeah, I've seen this clip. DeSantis is really feeling his oats with this up in New Hampshire. I mean, he's going to declare. Tim Scott, incidentally, declared today. We should just mention. In the vice presidential sweepstakes. And
don't forget the book sale sweepstakes, because he'll eventually write a book about his life.
Yep.
This is free advertising. Well, not so free.
I mean, he's doing it wrong if he's not selling his book now, actually, which is what they usually do. But here's Ron DeSantis up in New Hampshire. We don't know exactly when he's about to announce, when he's going to announce, but he's going to announce soon. Maybe he'll time it for the next thing that Donald Trump loses in court case. There's going to be a couple. And hoping this is the Ron DeSantis. I hope that Donald Trump has a cardiac event tour as he comes in. And here he is looking around. He's pretty excited.
He's trying to relate to people.
How are you doing? Wow, look at this. Hi, how are you guys? Good to see you. So what do you got? Go right over here? Okay, good deal. Good deal.
Wow.
Crowded, huh? Good. Hey, how are you doing? It smells really good, I'll tell you that. So we'll do it, okay.
Is that it? Do we not have more?
No, that's it. Yeah, that's just like a general kind of sense of his inability
politics.
To connect to people. Oh, yeah, his retail politics suck. Again, like, I return to when the trail derailment happened and Trump went to East Palestine and bought a bunch of McDonald's and stuff like that. And he was at Club for Growth fundraisers and meeting with police unions. The retail politics element, or the going into the diner and talking to people, he's just not good at that.
He just sounds like a robot, or like someone who has, like, never had a conversation with somebody before.
What's your name?
Tim Anthony. Okay.
Okay.
How are you doing?
Yeah. Nice to meet you.
frankly, honestly, he could get better at and can. I mean, it's not inconceivable that he won't. I just think that what really is the biggest issue that he's going to have is that he cannot run from his record in the way that he thinks he's going to. I mean, yeah. The guy never talks about the abortion ban there. There was a horrible story. In the Washington Post, about a couple that she was pregnant. They had a 4-year-old son, and past the date of the latest Florida abortion ban,
the new one,
found out that her pregnancy. That the through an ultrasound, I guess it was, they learned that their would-be baby had Potter syndrome, which is a rare and lethal condition. Basically has to do with an inability to essentially like process oxygen. The state's ban on abortion after 15 weeks, this is from the Washington Post, after 15 weeks of gestation has an exception for fatal fetal abnormalities. However, as long as the fetus's heart kept beating, doctors would not honor their request to terminate. The doctors would not say how they reached their decision, but the new law carries severe penalties, including prison time for medical practitioners who run afoul of it. Again, mention this in the context of Don't Say Gay. Mention this in the context of like the book banning that's there. Mention this in the context of all of these things that are being done in Florida. They are kept vague with severe penalties so that a significant portion of the ban is a function of people being afraid to run afoul of the ban. So these doctors faced with prison time are like, we're not going to terminate this pregnancy, even though maybe according to the letter of the law, I suppose if she was able to go to do a court case, it would have taken weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, months maybe, and maybe she could have gotten some type of preliminary order suggesting that they should do that. But instead...
Your camera's back. It was frozen for like 30 seconds.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Dropping a little bit of footage.
Instead, the Dorbits had to wait for labor to be induced at 37 weeks.
Jesus.
And the kid did not have functioning kidneys. That's what it is. They can't produce the amniotic fluid that allows the lungs to expand and cushion the body.
So she gave birth to a baby that was going
to
die.
She gave birth to a baby that gasped for air for 95 minutes and then died. And it has, according to her and her family, been like torture to sit there and watch that child die, knowing there is absolutely nothing that could be done to save its life. They begged for an end to that pregnancy. They never got it. There is no, she disputes like any type of notion that somehow this is like a good experience and there's something spiritual they've learned out of this. None of it. None of it. And this is, I would imagine, probably more common than we know. It doesn't necessarily involve Potter syndrome, but this is...
Would you want to tell the press if this happened to you?
This is... Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so we don't hear many of these stories. It was a 12-hour labor. The baby was 4 pounds, 12 ounces. Flawlessly formed hands and feet and brown hair, destined to die. The grandfather was there thinking like, well, maybe it's going to work. And they basically just held the child and watched the baby die.
State inflicted violence on this entire family.
Entire family.
I mean, I just keep thinking about the woman. I mean, we've all heard, I mean, maybe stories in families where like something horrific goes wrong and the baby, you know, chokes and dies and the mother still has to give birth to the child, right? Even in the ninth month. I think that happened to my grandmother. But worse, when you know in advance that the baby's going to die and you still put the woman through the labor process for what? As a punishment? I mean, how much trauma can that person endure? And it's just like, yeah. I mean, and it's a punishment by, you know, theocrats and stuff, but it's also like, you know, she had a son with this guy. This was just a regular family, and these are the kinds of stories that the abortion not that it matters, but like, that's why I'm less convinced that DeSantis is less dangerous than Donald Trump.
Well, it's interesting because I am quite sure that DeSantis is more dangerous than Donald Trump. I don't know that his ability to win is any greater, but certainly we have seen what he's willing to do when he's in a position of power, if he thinks it's going to help him. There was a new poll that came out by the AP and then the NORC Center for Public Affairs. 33% people approve of Joe Biden's handling of the economy. 24% say national economic conditions are in good shape, despite the fact that relative to any other time in the past 5-10 years, they're in pretty good shape. Now, we have fundamental problems with the economy in terms of, like, we need a higher minimum wage, which Joe Biden could have pushed for. In terms of employment, the numbers are still almost, you know, in 50 years as good as they've been. But nevertheless, that is the perspective on Joe Biden. 40% say they approve of the way that Biden is doing his job. That's more or less where his approval rating has been. Historically, that is not encouraging for somebody heading into a reelection campaign. However, Washington Post had a piece about these swing voter focus groups. And again, these are small, 15 voters. They had switched. They'd all cast a ballot for Trump in 2016 and then to Biden in 2020. 9 of the 15 said they would vote again for Biden. 3 said they would go back to Trump. And 3 said that they would either not vote or find a third party candidate. Whatever the step above panic is, that's what I feel about Trump, said Felicia, who voted for him in 2016. You can read that a couple of different ways. 3 out of 15 is still a pretty high percentage of switching back. It sort of depends on where they're located.
Yeah.
But that sadly seems to be like what the race is going to shape up to be, as far as we can tell now. I mean, you know, if there was ever a time where you would contemplate people's health having a role in a presidential election, when you're talking about Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we're headed. We'll see. Otto Matlack for the people. Could I get a shofar for my new job? I'm now working at the developer group. Wish me luck. All right, one last call. Call from at 804 area code. You are the final caller of the day. That catch? They go away.
I'm not seeing it.
Well, I'm going to try that again. 804. What is going on? Are they there? I'm not seeing it. Can you hit that 804? It's
804?
I can't get it.
It's gone now from me. Well, the voicemail's on, so we got it, right?
Calling from a 412 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? There's something wrong with my phone.
So. All right, you want me to pick up 412?
Sure.
I'm not seeing them either. All right, I'm going to pick up random...
Okay, no, let's just end it there.
Okay.
It's 226.
Okay.
Read some IMs. I don't know what's going on with my phone's there.
Okay.
Geo478, my boyfriend just got a letter in the mail saying he has to repay $2,400 in unemployment he got during the pandemic due to a miscalculation on their end.
Jeez.
The appeal process is all left on our shoulders. This should be illegal. The money's already spent. He doesn't make much. Jesus.
That's insane. Is that real? Or is that a... I'd be worried that...
That's a scam.
That's a scam. Because, like, why would... Like, sorry, you gave it to me, government. You deal with it. Go, you know, ask Bill Gates or something. That's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Should we do Tim Pool?
Sure.
Let's do this Tim Pool clip here. Oh, here we go. This is from Tim Pool's show on Friday. He is, they're mad because apparently people are saying that Lizzo is beautiful. I got to say, I'm vaguely familiar with Lizzo. I don't follow a lot of like cultural stuff like this, but it is so weird.
How obsessed they are with her?
How obsessed they are with defining what other people think is beautiful.
Sorry. Not beautiful. They're just horrified that someone who isn't a skinny white woman is being represented in music. And that there's a whole group of people that find her inspirational to have her be a pop star who's black and a pop star who's plus sized. That's a threat to Tim Pool somehow.
These guys have racist but horned up audiences. This is the same reason you have Crowder having to go through every time Cardi B or Megan Thee Stallion makes news. Like, black women being sexy is something that is like really good for their engagement.
Here is Tim Pool. How does he identify politically anymore? Or has he given up that ghost?
He says he's a centrist.
Is he a centrist now?
He copped to the what people use as an insult as a milquetoast fence sitter. I mean, I'd call him as a laundromat for right wing talking points. But yeah, he calls himself a sort of fence sitter.
Okay. Most profitable. If
they keep coming out and saying people like Lizzo are beautiful, like, this is going to lead to a high mortality rate for a lot of people. Once again, it is resulting in the loss of life on the left. The right is more likely to be like, cut out the sugar, stop eating seed oils. How many people?
Hold on. I'm old enough to remember when the right was really, really mad at Michelle Obama because Michelle Obama said, let's get active and let's have healthy school lunches. The authoritarian left at it again, telling us what we can and cannot eat. And now they're concerned about obesity being promoted because, like, there's a band nerd named Lizzo who got famous and sings songs.
It's also just sort of like, where is the conservative movement saying eat less seed oil? Or
that's a new like Tucker hippie reactionary thing that's coming around.
Right, it's the Roganification of everything. And
it's
like,
soy. I think sort of
soy.
Like the
they're worried
sort of
about
like
right. It's feminizing everybody where there's no scientific basis to that. And then also,
is this part of the I need to tan my
ball sack?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean,
there's chemicals in the water. They're coming to feminize you. It's the version of Alex Jones's. They're turning the frickin' frogs gay.
Right, right.
Once again, it is resulting in the loss of life on the left. The right is more likely to be like, cut out the sugar, stop eating seed oils. How many times have you heard in the past week, stop eating seed oils? Like, come on. The right won't shut up about it.
That and the microplastics.
Microplastics. But see, like, the right, whatever that is, is trying.
I mean, you know what's fascinating, too, is that, microplastics like polysaturate, like, I mean, the ones that New York made illegal 15 years ago?
That we've been talking about at, like, TART conferences and stuff.
Yeah,
like
I mean.
What was the chemical that Florida just made legal that you can pave roads with?
Oh, yeah.
Immensely toxic?
Yeah. That literally radiated roads that the EPA has said is illegal for 30 years.
Yeah, it's the left that's,
this is fascinating.
Wants to poison you.
Also, there's a lot of unfit right wingers, obviously.
And let me say, too, if you're taking any of those supplements from Rogan's website or Alex Jones's website, very underregulated. You have no idea what's in there.
But it's just so fascinating that, how desperately Tim wants the conservative movement to be something that other than it is. As if the conservative movement was defined by don't eat sugar. Are you? That's just insane. Continue.
How many times have you heard in the past week, stop eating seed oils? Like, come on. The right won't shut up about it.
That and the microplastics.
Microplastics. But see, like,
it's Rogan
the
stuff,
right,
yeah.
Whatever that is trying really hard to be healthy, to be responsible. I got glass bottle water here. We get it for all our guests. You do have plastic because we're not that crazy. We just try to do better. But if the long run, the trajectory just seems very simple.
Also,
the left starts
did he just admit, too, that he's on the right?
Slipped
didn't
a little
he
bit.
Just admit to being on the right?
Yeah.
Didn't he just say,
thanks,
the right's trying to be responsible, I got glass bottles? Go back a little bit. I mean, I'm just curious.
The right won't shut up about it.
That and the microplastics.
Microplastics. But see, like, the right, whatever that is trying really hard to be healthy, to be responsible. I got glass bottle water here. Oh. We get it for all our guests. You do have plastic because we're not that crazy.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. We just try to do better.
But the long
run, the trajectory just seems very simple. The left starts to disappear and the right expands.
I get what you're saying, but like historically when we've seen these kind of ideologies try to push for influence and stuff, there's mass death. So you could be right. There could be a lot of people that end up dying. But that's also something that happens.
Mass death in which direction?
I mean, well, if they get in control, so if they stupid. Get into positions of power and actually can decide, can make policy, then you're going to end up seeing a massive push for the reduction of carbon usage and that means reduction of energy usage. They don't want to use petrochemicals to fertilize any plants and stuff. So you're going to see famines. You're going to see death not just left, but conservatives too.
Why conservatives?
Because it would be a worldwide death because you'll see like, you'll see significant famine. It's not going to start with the U.S.
Now, this is fascinating because I don't know who this dude is. Who is this guy?
The history understander? Sorry, I didn't have him on the sheet. He's Phil Labonte, Sam. He's a singer, former member of the band All That Remains. He's now a TimCast
I don't know any of that.
Contributor.
Sure. But I haven't heard of that band. But what's fascinating is to watch Tim catch up with what this guy's saying. Because this guy is saying, well, that's all well and good that conservatives are now concerned about things like the environment and health, like, you know, but what if it becomes like the EPA and the FDA? Like, what if the conservatives actually attempt to make the world a healthier place? Then it could go too far and kill everybody in a famine. But I got to see if like Tim actually catches up with where this guy is going, because Tim is on one hand saying like, we're much more conscious of the environment and health than the left is.
Yeah.
Oops, and they're killing themselves. Those idiots.
Yeah. And then the guy's going, but we don't want to in any way spread that as a government policy because that will lead to famine.
No, because it needs to be individualized. This is like, hey, listen to my show. These are the tips that you need to make sure that you're not getting poisoned. But when it becomes government policy, that's authoritarian.
Incidentally, we're selling glass bottles at our merch store. We're not.
No.
Okay.
Conservatives.
Because it would be a worldwide death because you'll see like, you'll see significant famine. It's not going to start with the U.S. It'll be in places where there's already on the edge of famine.
That's American conservatives will be the last to go.
Sure.
And then what happens 20 years later?
What?
Conservative United States.
I mean, maybe.
So we can put it this way. This.
Wait a second. Wait, he doesn't get what the guy's saying. He doesn't get what the guy's saying. He doesn't understand the guy in a white shirt is trying to say, like, but
it's cataclysmic.
We don't want any of these people who are trying to push this stuff get into power because then they'll get rid of fossil fuels and then we'll have a famine. But Tim is still on his shtick where, like, I think what Tim's trying to argue here is that because conservatives are on this big no sugar kick, which incidentally, I've got to tell you, Tim needs to get out of his compound a little bit more because he should check in on parts of the, you know, like what's going on in around the country. I think he's going to find.
I think it's all
that,
water bottles.
I think he's going to find that. It's not glass bottles. It's so funny. He's adopted all of the sort of criticisms of the elite, the coastal elite, and doesn't recognize. If you want to look at sugar consumption around the country, I would not want to bet that it falls on ideological grounds. But he's watched three videos this week that tell him, and so it's impact his full worldview. But in his world, because he's seen Joe Rogan talk about don't take sugar for the past 3 weeks, he thinks that only conservatives are going to be alive in 30 years. Because all the liberals are killing themselves with sugar.
And Lizzo. Let me just remind you that this segment started with him complaining about Lizzo.
And part of him, like, I think he knows what conservatives come to him for is a bedtime story that will make them, like, drift off to happy sleep. So that when you get catastrophic, like, the libs are going to get in charge and then lead to famines, that's not really, like, what they're there for. They want to hear that they want to hear from a centrist that they're winning and everything's going to be okay.
Exactly.
This will be the last to go.
Sure.
And then what happens 20 years later, conservative United States.
I mean, maybe.
So we can put it this way. Let's say there's two potential forks, the left sterilizing and aborting their kids. They're promoting unhealthy lifestyles and promoting sterilization of individuals. Over a long enough period of time, they just won't exist. Well, let me finish. That's one potential. The other potential is they gain massive political power over the institutions, take over, and then start culling their opponents. Either way, the Great Famine, whatever ends up happening, as we often see with big communist regimes, the Soviet Union lasted about 69 years. And then what happens? It falls apart. If it does, conservatives, who tend to have their own sources of food to a greater degree than liberals...
This is so, like... It's honestly as if, like, you were to give a 7-year-old some type of, like, word generation machine. Mm-hmm. So, incidentally, there's two options. Let's just be clear. Let's just review here. One option is that somehow, regardless of what the demographic trends are, because Joe Rogan says don't eat sugar, that all the liberals are going to die out. It's going to become a conservative country. The other is that, no, 100% opposite thing happens that is in some way untethered from my theory about nutrition, that they're going to take over instead of dying out and cull everybody else, their opponents. However, the mass sterilization that apparently the liberals promote, incidentally,
through abortion.
Nobody's talking about. He's not talking about trans.
Oh,
what was the figure of people not surgery, but got trans care under the age of 20 was somewhere like 4,000 in a country of 300 million.
Yep.
And this guy's building a futuristic trend. If the trend continues at this rate, they're going to get, and incidentally, also, he should look at abortion statistics.
Yeah.
Because I got news for you. It's not just liberals who get abortions. Like, all of this stuff is so...
It's bullshit.
It's abstract on purpose.
Like, but... I just don't even think, like, you can't lie like this unless you are just completely uninformed.
Yeah.
Like, it would be too embarrassing to have these words come out of your mouth if you had any awareness of anything.
Yeah.
He's like a human ChatGPT. He's just talking.
Yes, without the inputs.
Yeah.
But he knows. Well, the inputs are, you know, this new
Crowder.
Kind of anti,
yeah, exactly.
anti-science skepticism of what's in your food. You're going to get empowered about your healthcare, medical freedom, but that just means buy my supplements and mistrust the government. That's what they're leaning into here. And so those are the inputs, and then he's just free flowing. But, like,
he listens to not just Crowder and Rogan, but also Jones. Alex Jones.
Yeah. He so, does. Yeah.
And therefore, he's putting this together. All right. So let's now just which I don't know what scenario we're on. The one where liberals completely fall apart because they're eating too much sugar, or the one where they cull the herd of conservatives.
But then that comes back around because there's the great famine that we all know is coming.
Right.
Obviously.
Power of the institutions take over and then start culling their opponents. Either way, the Great Famine, whatever ends up happening, as we often see with big communist regimes, the Soviet Union lasted about 69 years. And then what happens? It falls apart. If it does, conservatives, who tend to have their own sources of food to a greater degree than liberals,
been culled,
the pressure is still apparent. The left taking over means famine and death. But it's the people in the cities who are urban liberals who are the first to struggle and have no access to resources. Conservatives are going to be out in the middle of nowhere with chickens, goats, guns, and a garden. At the very least, not every single one will strive. Well, I'm sorry, will thrive. But many of them will be okay. Plus, all the preppers are right-leaning.
I think
this is just, like, honestly, like, it's hard to imagine an adult talking like this and it not being a bit. Was there a part, let's just be fair about this, do we know if like 2 minutes later he goes, I'm joking.
I mean, so wait, the segment started with Lizzo. I'm just returning to that. And now we're at Soviet Union levels of famine where
because that's the first part of a communist revolution.
Yeah.
Lizzo say, being, you know, in a dress.
Existing. Yeah. She played the flute, too.
It really is. I think you have nailed it, though, Matt, in terms of like this is bedtime story.
Yep.
Program.
But it also fuels the kind of survival kit conservatism.
Yeah, but it's like that you're going to win. Like,
yeah,
but it's like
get all your guns and hide in your bunker like Tim has.
They're doing a race war, which, by the way, we're going to win. It's going to be laughable because they're all like, you know, pink hairs.
And the Democrats are having soy, so they're weak.
Yeah.
She's like, why are you guys worried then, dude?
There's another thing Lizzo did that sort of put her in the news recently. This was do you have the details for this, Bradley? This is from, this was in Tennessee, I'm pretty sure. Recently, this was
in Nebraska,
yeah,
a concert that she did.
I saw this. Good for her. This is part of also why she's a threat.
And anybody who comes to a Lizzo show should know that I am for people to have the right.
Big Nebraska crowd.
It sounds like it's very political, and as adults, we feel it, but there's children here tonight. And it really breaks my heart that there are young people growing up in a world that doesn't protect them. Let me be your safe space tonight and just tell young people don't let anybody tell you who you are. Don't let any laws tell you who you're not, bitch. You are inside San Diego. Don't let any laws tell you who you're not. You are who you are, okay? I see you. You are valid. You deserve to be here.
Too bad all those people are going to be dying of either too much sugar or the coming liberal procured famine.
And that was just hours after Nebraska Senate voted to further restrict access to abortion and gender affirming care for minors. And like, I think that like if you're an entertainer that plays in one of those states, that is, you know, an awesome thing to do.
Yep. All right. That ends the phone portion of our program. Trying to hang up these things. And we'll read some IMs. We'll get out of here. Got to be quick. Got to be quick. Dezubly. Sent the graphics. Great. Thank you. Kinnick. Great interview today and something I've been whining about for years now. My company has spent over $6 million on a big four consulting team since the pandemic began, primarily doing inflation analysis. In the meantime, our turnover has exploded since we're having to run leaner than ever before. Even worse, the consultants have a complete lack of knowledge of our space, but we continue to funnel them business. I'm convinced our CFO is either getting kickbacks or just has a cozy relationship with someone high up at the firm we're using. I in my limited experience with corporations, from myself and people that I know and have seen, I think the amount of contracts that are issued to people, 6 and 7 figure contracts, like this, entities, has so much to do with just like, these are my buddies. Mm-hmm. And I know that they're gonna send it to me. And I'm talking about Fortune 500 companies.
Mm.
Quinn from Minnesota. It's the BMV here in Indiana, Bureau of Motor Vehicles. Adam from Weston, Mass. I can't believe Sam didn't mention that no team came back from 3-0 in baseball until the Red Sox did it in 04.
Oh, yeah.
Keep the hope, Sam. Yeah, I forgot about that. I missed that in many ways. I didn't fully experience it because it was in the run-up to the Bush election. And I don't even want to get into it. Drew from Vegas. If we truly, all the games were played when we were on the show. If we truly lived in a meritocracy, the first people jobs replaced by AI would be C-suite execs, but it won't because we don't. Illuminati kids, I'm not sure what the point was of the coastal liberal roasting was. Leaving an impressive small town environment for a city to be able to find in other members of your community is a pretty positive experience. Indeed. Way, way younger than Sam. I saw a cool, video where they showcased how you could use AI to actually have the whole conversation with a voice NPC instead of just clicking pre-selected options. And as long as everyone else is compensated properly, that sounds really cool. There's a lot of really cool stuff I think that could happen. But there's no reason to believe that people are going to be fairly compensated.
No. Yeah, right.
Let's see. Nico. If Ukraine was part of Russia, they would be treated like serfs and used as fodder for the next invasion. IM or should just admit they don't care about anything besides their outside fear and comfort. The jury is still out on City by Karen. Her lawyer is showing receipts with the timestamp removed.
I don't know. I'm annoyed that, like, yeah, I hear though that, like, we shouldn't be commenting on viral videos like that without more information. That's how I feel.
Disco Stew, my favorite part of the GOP primary is that if Trump wins, he's a historically bad candidate, and if he loses, he'll say it was rigged and burn the whole thing down. Still worried Biden is too old, but all things considered, it's not a bad place for Dems to be. Five more. Golden Oyster Cult. The Town is an incredible film, and Ben Affleck, whatever his issues, aside from Live by Night, is making masterpieces out there.
It's okay. I mean, The Departed is like the way better version of that kind of movie. Sorry.
The Town, yeah.
Yeah. It's fine.
Underworld Boston.
Yeah.
Adil, have you ever had Mariana Mazzucato Cato on the show? She's written a great book called The Value of Everything. Well, she co-wrote the one we just had on today. Mm. But yes, we have tried to get her on for years.
We haven't had her?
No.
I think Michael talked to her.
I don't understand what's going on, but I have been asking Brendan to have her on for literally 5 or 6 years.
Mm.
Tech Bro. Reminder that if you're comparing two slurs, you have to abbreviate one of them. That's the worst one.
Yeah, right.
Street Beats. Y'all may have missed Tool's lead singer dressed in drag at the Rockville concert in Daytona. Definitely right-wing heads exploded at the show. Chris Burdick. Did some other organization... Insanity. And the final IM of the day... Greg from Georgia, when you inform a normal person that something they said was possibly racist, they'll ask with genuine concern why or how that what they said could be taken as racist. A racist person will deny it ever having said something racist and even deny the very existence of such a thing. Well said. All right, Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job today. See you folks tomorrow. Check out ESPN today.
Yes.
For all of their anti-Celtic propaganda. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the Mets are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid.